Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The red carpet rolled out last week north of Shanghai for a new Hollywood in China. Leonardo DiCaprio was there, Nicole Kidman, John Travolta, Harvey Weinstein, Catherine Zeta-Jones, a whole lot of Chinese film stars, and the richest man in China, who says China's box office will outpace America's in 5 years. China is putting up its own Hollywood sign and looking to take in and take on the world. This hour, On Point, the Chinese dream up against the American dream on the big screen. Where does this go? What will it look like? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you expect to see in China's global cultural footprint in the movies? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. If you saw Iron Man 3 in the United States, you probably didn't see all the extra minutes that viewers in China saw, with two Chinese actors, stars Shi-Chi Wang and Fan Bingbing, washing their hands in preparation for an operation on Iron Man. Here they are. Putting Robert Downey Jr. under anesthesia before they go in for an operation. It was a part of the film for China. It wasn't here at all. And last week in Qingdao, China, rolling out a new Hollywood, a new kind of Disney World and studios and all the rest. Lots of American stars on the red carpet there. Robert Downey wasn't there, but he's talked a lot already about how important it is for this to be big, big, big. That is, American stars looking at the future of film in China, what Chinese need to know about him, for example.
People who know me back in America know that I'm very interested in all things Chinese. I live a fairly Chinese life in America.
You got that? The American star telling China, I live a Chinese life in America. And at the big opening of the Oriental movie Metropolis last week, here's John Travolta saying he's excited for the growth of Chinese cinema.
I'm loving this injection of life into the movie industry that we need so much. So I hope to be making movies here, and I hope that my friends will make movies here, and it will be a wonderful future.
Big ambitions. Where does this go? Joining us now from Beijing in China is Lori Burkett, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She covers China's entertainment sector and more. Last week, she was in Qingdao, China, where a big movie dream is being rolled out. Lori Burkett in Beijing. Welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom. Nice to meet with you.
Can you please describe what Mr. Wang Jianlin is building in Qingdao?
Well, this is definitely an aspiration to become the next Hollywood. I was looking up some of the details, and it's 40.5 million square feet. So just to give you an idea, that's about 703 football fields. That's huge. It's massive. And this is a guy who really intends to make it work. So it's not only film studios, but think also theme parks. Wax museum, a film museum, everything to attract tourists, big hotels, yachting complexes. I mean, this thing really, it will be a city.
And 20 movie-making studios there. Who does Mr. Wang picture using those? All Chinese directors and productions? American productions? Hybrid productions?
Well, what he did was he flew out a number of Hollywood stars. So we had Leonardo DiCaprio, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Nicole Kidman, John Travolta, tons of names there that he got. And those stars, he actually signed agreements with them, with global talent agencies, to get them to be doing around 30 films each year at those studios. So that's sort of the intention, to build up a more international image. And then on top of that, they do want to build up a local production facility as well. So they're going to bring on 50 domestic film and television production companies to work with Wanda. That's Wang Jianlin's studio, company. And work with them to produce about 100 homegrown films and shows each year.
The scale of this thing is kind of mind-boggling, and this is only one location where he's investing in movies and entertainment. He's a very rich guy indeed. On the other hand, Lori, the total box office in China last year was something $2 billion in change. In the United States, it's $10 billion plus. Those seem on quite different scales.
Yeah, I think we need to remember that we're just getting started here in China. So here's a guy who is a property man, and he's certainly built up a host of shopping malls and has started building up yachts and yacht infrastructure around the coast of China. And he needs to attract people to those properties. So he's also started to build movie theaters, and he's started the screen business around China, done deals with IMAX, and is getting people to go into the shopping malls that he's created and starting to watch films. So yes, you're right that $2.74 billion, which was the box office figure for last year, is still pretty small in comparison to the U.S., but I got to say that it's growing, and it's about 30% growth from 2011. So that's big. I mean, when we're talking about the U.S., which is a rather stagnant market, I think 30% is really attractive for most people.
Mr. Wang talking about matching American box office within 5 years. Of course, he's already got a foot in the United States. He owns AMC movie theaters in this country, a huge chain of cinemas in the United States, Lori.
Yeah, he bought in last year $2.6 billion, right? Which I think most people were really surprised about, because this was not a thriving industry that someone might see that a Chinese company would want to jump into. But it certainly makes sense at a time when China would like to build up its overseas image. So I think there's a desire to move into this soft culture power space, where they can really build up a name for China in the same way that Hollywood has done for America, because all over the globe, people watch American movies and have a much more friendlier vision of what America is. And I think China hopes to build that as well with its movies and its companies, too.
Here's China's richest man, Wang Jianlin, at the Qingdao Oriental Movie Metropolis, groundbreaking last week. All kinds of stars around saying, hey, in entertainment, things are going to be different. Here he is interpreted by CCTV.
The film industry in China has just started and has a bright future. I believe if Western film and entertainment industries can make use of the rapidly developing Chinese market, it will be beneficial for both sides. That's why so many stars like to come to China nowadays. It's quite different from previous years.
The richest man in China saying, watch out. Lori Burke at standby in Beijing. With us now from Santa Barbara, California, is Michael Berry, professor of contemporary Chinese cultural studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, author of Speaking in Images, Interviews with Contemporary Chinese Filmmakers. Michael Berry, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, there's a huge development here. He's a real estate guy. He's got a lot of studios coming out here, enormous ambitions. What do you see coming, Michael? Because there's also this talk about, well, Hollywood has promoted your American dream. Now Chinese films will promote a Chinese dream. Do you see a Chinese dream on the screen selling globally, Michael?
I do, but it's going to be a very long and complicated road to get there. There definitely are those global ambitions, and there have been some very successful Chinese language films produced over the last, say, 15 years, especially, mm-hmm. say, 2000. We had Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which really was a game changer for the entire industry. It was that film that really led a lot of major Hollywood production companies to go to Asia to open up their doors, to start working on more co-productions. A few years later, that was followed by a whole string of PRC directors like Zhang Yimou, Chen Kaige, Feng Xiaogang, some of the leading names in mainland Chinese cinema, kind of completely retooling the way they make films to make Chinese-style blockbusters, which was a whole new genre, so to speak. And most of them were set in pre-modern China with incredible martial arts spectacles, A-list stars, often drawn from a pan-Asian or pan-Chinese grouping, so not just Chinese stars, but top stars from Taiwan, Hong Kong, mm-hmm. and sometimes even overseas. Enlisting people like Itzhak Perlman and Yo-Yo Ma to score the films. And this was a whole new formula that spawned Hero, which actually was a film by Zhang Yimou in, I believe, 2002 that mm-hmm. was number one at the U.S. box office. And you had a whole segment of these types of new blockbusters that were very successful in the Chinese market, the U.S. market, and various other global markets. However, that formula seems to have teetered out over time. And China has been continually trying to find the next formula that's going to work for both markets. And at the same time, Hollywood has been trying to find a market that's a formula that's going to sell both at home and in the Chinese market. I think the ideal for both sides is to have a product that can perform just as well for in both sides. But that's been the tough part of this equation. And often you get a film that performs very well in one market and kind of falters or just has mediocre performance in the other. But studios with increasingly bloated budgets, you know, these $100 million budgets, that's a necessity for them these days to have a film that is going to perform the numbers in both markets in order to make a profit.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's big global plans for the movie business. Its studios, its ambitions, it's Hollywood and ours. Michael Berry is with us from Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara. Laurie Burkett is here from the Wall Street Journal, joins us from Beijing, China. Michael mentioned Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. This is back in 2000, directed by Ang Lee. Here's a scene dubbed into English, warrior Yu Shulian, played by Michael Yeo, meets Jen, played by Zhang Ziyi. Jen's the daughter of an aristocrat selected for an arranged marriage.
My parents are arranging everything. We became acquainted with Lu Yunpei when we first got here. My mother says the Lu clan is very powerful and highly ranked, and that my marrying one of them will help father's career a great deal.
Entering such a noble house, I should think, is a great honor.
Yes, but I wish that I were like the exciting heroes in the stories I read, characters like Li Mubai and yourself.
Whole lots of Chinese names going on there, but it did great business around the world. Here just last week at the rollout of the big new Qingdao Oriental Movie Metropolis, Chinese superstar Jet Li, interpreted here by CCTV.
I'm very happy that Wanda chose the city of Qingdao. The city is very beautiful. There will be more people coming here to make films and have film festivals. This is the happiest thing for filmmakers.
And IMAX, huge in China. IMAX after IMAX, those big sort of hemisphere theaters rolling out across the country. Here in March last year, the CEO of IMAX talked about the growth of the film industry in China with Bloomberg News.
The government is specifically committed to growing cinema in China. There are 5,000 theaters today. They've said there'll be about 25,000 in 5 years and 10,000 in 10 years, making it the largest cinema market in the world.
Big ambitions, big scale, lots of building going on all the time. Michael Berry, Laurie Burkett, please stand by with us right now from Seoul, South Korea, where he's attending the Busan International Film Festival, has been in Korea, is Jeffrey Chan. He's Chief Operating Officer and Director of Bona Film Group, big Chinese production distribution company. They've got deals in the works with five co-productions with American companies, Universal, Working Title Films, Fox International Productions. Jeffrey Chan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Thomas.
How do you see China's ambition here? Is it to make great films for the Chinese market or great films for the world to compete with Hollywood?
I won't say we will compete with Hollywood, but surely we would make bigger and better films for Chinese audience and also hopefully for the international audience as well.
Will Chinese films sell internationally, Jeffrey Chan?
I think I heard Michael talk about it. Based on history, it did. But over time, that formula seems to be petering away. And I'm sure that with the joint effort, not just from the Chinese producers, maybe for the U.S. producer together, we will be able to find a new formula that works.
How is it so far in co-productions? You know, is it easy to get the actors working together, the American directors and Chinese production crews working together, or is that problematic?
Well, every kind of productions will have its problem to deal with. That's what the responsibility of producers are there for.
Mm-hmm.
But I think generally there's a common goal and a common aim and common target to achieve, and I'm sure that's the driving force to make things happen and smooth things out.
So what do you expect, let's say, from Mr. Wang Jianlin's new sort of Hollywood studio development? Do you imagine a Hollywood and box office in China on the same scale as the United States, as he does, within 5-10 years?
China is the fastest growing market at the moment, and a lot of things are being built with more and more screens. And with the sea size of the population, I'm sure sooner or later it will become the single largest market for films. I think everybody would have no question about that. It's a matter of time. But as far as what Mr. Wang is and the group is doing, I don't know the strategy and the underlying business logic to make any meaningful comment on such a bold move. But this is a very strong statement telling the world, I think in no uncertain terms, that China is serious to be a very strong player in shaping world cinema in all aspects. And from this perspective, from this angle, this is something we ourselves being Chinese and a member of the Chinese film industry should be proud of.
Jeffrey, do you think that that scale of the Chinese film market will ultimately change the flavor of American films that will want to sell there?
I think there are all kinds of American films, but if you're talking about U.S. blockbusters, as in my opinion, U.S. These big budget films are not made just for the U.S. audience. It's been made for the international audience, and China is being part of it, and it's becoming a bigger part of it. And I'm sure with all the experience and expertise behind the studios, I'm sure they will be shaping the formula in a way that it would be able to cater for even bigger audience, including the Chinese.
Maybe that will mean even more big action blockbusters. Jeffrey Chan with Bona Film Group joining us today from Seoul, South Korea. Thank you so much, Mr. Chan, for being here.
Thank you.
Let's bring it home, bring our listeners in. Mackenzie's calling from Cookeville, Tennessee. Mackenzie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just spent 5 years in China, and while I was there, I had a chance to work at the Beijing International Film Festival, the one that just passed this year.
Yeah.
And I was helping promote my friend Zhao Bandi's movie. He's an artist from 798. He managed to, that's a famous art district in Beijing.
Yes.
And he self-financed his own art movie. It's a really interesting production. I recommend everybody see it. It's Let Panda Fly. It's really cute. But, you know, the big question, I think, that not a lot of your callers are addressing is what is the kind of film quality that's going to be produced with this kind of going forward? You know, I hear a lot of people talking about how big the market is. But, you know, when you go into China, one of the realities you're going to have to face with film production, with film promotion, is that you have to pay the media for positive reviews, and that includes social media. They have a lot of thought leaders that you have to pay directly, and networks of thought leaders, people who will go on comment sites, and they will pay a movie for pay even before they've seen it.
Wow. They'll
say, oh, I haven't seen this movie, and it's, I give it a zero.
So pay to play. Like, and what about the kind of films that are popular there? How do you think it might influence American film production, Mackenzie?
Well, I mean, if you're interested in creating, a major Hollywood blockbuster, put a gun in your movie, it's going to sell. okay? Put explosions and 3D graphics. It's going to sell because that's the kind of image that America's projecting for itself in the Chinese market. That's what they think of us because that's what we sell them. I'll give you a good example of something that was able to break through. I mean, if you're a Oscar reviewer, right? If you're if you're up there selecting what films are going to win, you can affect this because they do pay attention to the Oscars. So The King's Speech actually got traction. You know, a film like The King's Speech did get some traction in China because it was, you know, because it was so highly lauded at the Academy Awards. But you know, aside from that, it's just major 3D productions that get the Avengers, all the Marvel superheroes. And
Mackenzie, we've got it. Listen, welcome home from your 5 years in China. I really appreciate your call. Michael Berry, how about it? If you have a big market, it has an influence. Here comes a very big market. What influence do you anticipate?
Well, I think we're already seeing an incredible change that's taking place even before this announcement by Wang Jianlin. Mm. Part of that, a few minutes ago, Tom, you had asked, what is this future going to look like? Well, I think to some degree, it's already here. If you look at, say, a lot of the caller just mentioned the Avengers and these big budget kind of superhero movies. You look at a lot of those big action franchises from Transformers to X-Men to Iron Man, and the list goes on and on. Increasingly, all of them are casting major Chinese stars in these films. So the next X-Men film, which is in production now, I believe cast Fan Bingbing in a role. Transformers 4 is going to be a Chinese co-production with other Chinese stars. We already talked about Iron Man. So this change, whether it's visible to American audiences or not, as you pointed out, some of the Chinese scenes were cut out in the American release of Iron Man 3, but it's already taking place. And just a few, fairly recently, Wang Jianlin was giving an interview in China, and he made a direct reference to Iron Man 3 and that type of production. And this is a quote of him where he basically says, Hollywood wants to make money by throwing in a few famous Chinese actors, giving them a few scenes and a handful of lines, and then cutting them out of the North American market. If American film companies approach China like some kind of money tree and don't respect the Chinese market and respect Chinese consumers, then these types of companies are destined to fail in the Chinese market. So that's a very clear dissatisfaction with the type of approach that, say, Iron Man 3 took,
wow,
where it's almost a perfunctory way to embrace the Chinese market. And so I think that's a very clear sign that the formula that Hollywood has been playing with for the last few years and still is right now is not quite satisfying what people like Wang Jianlin want to see. And so I would anticipate a much more integrated form of co-productions that are going to be taking place. Whether or not they'll be successful is a whole other story, because you need a convincing screenplay that's really going to integrate these different cultural elements and not just be a perfunctory way to kind of please different markets or qualify for a co-production as a co-production with China get various.
Lori Burkett, there in Beijing, that co-production status is advantageous because there are limits in how many American films can come into China each year. And I guess if it's truly a co-production, they can bypass that quota system and get a bigger share of the film revenue in China.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you have a cap on the number of foreign movies that can be let into the market each year. And that number has actually been extended to, I think, 34. Michael, you might know the number better than I do. I think it's 34 right now. But 14 of those are 3D. So, I mean, that sort of explains why we've seen so much of the 3D explosion here. One, it's newer to Chinese audiences and they like it. But two, it helps to get past that quota. And likewise, so does the co-production. But one thing I do want to address that, you know, Michael, you just talked about, is that there was this idea of bringing in the sort of perfunctory add-ons, you know, that we stuck in Fenn Bingbing and Iron Man just to bring her in and satisfy. But I do think it also speaks to the fact that people really haven't understood what Chinese audiences have wanted, because there's been a taste for Hollywood. If you look at the top grossing films last year, a lot of them were from Hollywood. And so there's been this desire to have Hollywood. I mean, that's part of the reason that Wang Jianlin brought all of the Hollywood stars over here and wants to work with them. But at the same time, I think we're seeing a much growing or a bigger taste for local production. So it's really been a mix and match of trying to figure out what do audiences want, and are these add-ons, you know, just necessary to appease the government, or are we just trying to figure out, does the audience want that, and does Hollywood need that?
And then there's the whole political screen. We'll look at that as well. We're looking at the big ambitions and big market for the movie business in China. Lori, here's a listener we asked on Facebook. We said, you know, can you picture Chinese entertainment one day overtaking Hollywood? And here's one of our listeners says, not unless their nation becomes less homogeneous. This listener writes, the broad appeal of American entertainment comes as much from our diversity as our talent. What about that observation on Chinese culture and the global film market, Lori?
Yeah, I do think that there is some discussion about that. I mean, part of America's romance is that it has attracted people from all over the world, and it has a very compelling story to tell as a country. But I do think the other thing is that we've just had a longer time of figuring out how to tell stories. And I do think, you know, Michael mentioned earlier that a lot of Chinese films actually did make it globally. And we had a period of time when they did seem to have a winning recipe. I think the issue is trying to figure that out without trying to milk this Chinese story too much, because most of the, you know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, that was a great Chinese film. But can we tell stories that don't have, you know, a Chinese historical reference and that will appeal to the global audience? And that's still really up for grabs.
And is there enough political real estate to work with if you move forward, present day, out of history? Chris in New Orleans. Chris, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's I got to tell you, from somebody that's actually seen Hollywood South pop up down here in New Orleans, it really is becoming more of a global thing when it comes to all the film producers and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And I just really feel that it's leading towards more of a globalization of film.
In a good way, Chris, or not a good way? What do you think?
More of a good way. I mean, nationalism aside, you can easily make film into this international, I don't want to go and say Star Trek, but Star Trek style. It's going that way, because, I mean, you look at the aspect of the economy and everything else, we're starting to interaffect each other through, you know, geopolitics and stuff like that. But just, I feel that film overall can tie us together, even through the fact that we, you know, do tie film with nationalism and stuff like that.
Yeah, we'll look at it. Thank you, Chris in New Orleans. Michael Berry, how about it? Film is the great globalizer, sort of, you know, bringing understanding between peoples. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, that raises an interesting question, because Hollywood has always been a global industry. Although the name itself, Hollywood, points to the specific place in Los Angeles, Hollywood, you know, Hollywood film, you look at films like The Dark Knight Rises, where you have a lead actor and a director who are not American, but much of the film is shot outside of America. And yet nobody would question that this is a Hollywood product, because Hollywood points to this global formula that is marketed to the world. The Chinese industry, on the other hand, historically, had always had a very strong national cinema model. And so 20 years ago, if you looked at almost any typical Chinese film, it would say produced by a single film studio. It would probably be the Beijing Film Studio, mm-hmm. Changchun Studio, or a certain film studio, a completely Chinese cast. And nobody would question that kind of where it was coming from.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's big global plans for the movie business. its studios, its ambition, its Hollywood, and ours. Here from the top of the Chinese box office right now is the film My Lucky Star. Action comedy features Chinese star Zhang Ziyi as a goofy young woman who gets involved with a super spy. Here's a bit of that trailer.
The infamous Mr. Gao has been contracted to retrieve a diamond. I need you to go to Singapore.
This is about the lucky star.
Well, sounds familiar. How much will translate? We will see. With Laurie Burkett with the Wall Street Journal in Beijing, China, joining us today. Michael Berry at UC Santa Barbara, joining us from Santa Barbara, California. And with us right now from Los Angeles, John Horn, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, covers the film business. John Horn, thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to be here, Tom.
That turnout for Mr. Wang's big party last week made it look as though American filmmakers are paying and actors are paying a lot of attention to China. What's the movement? What's the migration here, John?
Well, I think appearances can be a little bit deceiving in terms of those appearances. Okay. I talked to somebody who works in China, and his speculation, he didn't have direct knowledge, but his speculation was those actors were paid as much as $500,000 to show up in
wow.
an appearance fee and flown on private jets over to China. So I think it's one thing to get people to show up for a news conference. It's another thing entirely to get a big American actor to move to China for 3 months to make a movie.
I mean, you hear Robert Downey Jr. saying, look, I live a very Chinese life in America, and saying that if you want to prosper as an American actor, you'd better warm up to this market. If they go from 2.7 billion in box office to 10 or more, which is what Mr. Wang is predicting, surely that will turn a lot of heads in American Hollywood, John.
Oh, definitely. And I think some of your guests have mentioned the American studios are trying to figure out a way to satisfy that market. You talked a little bit about Iron Man 3 and the complaints about Fan Bingbing having kind of a cameo that was only in the Chinese language version, and she was cut from the American language version of the film. The movie nevertheless grossed $121 million in China, so it was a huge hit. So I think Chinese audiences are far more welcoming of American content, even without Chinese characters or Chinese actors in them. I think the real issue is going to be to what lengths Hollywood will go to satisfy Chinese censors. That, to me, is the story that Hollywood is really have to figure out right now. Very recently, there was a film called World War Z, a Brad Pitt film, and
yeah.
the trailer for the film, there's reference to how China was kind of central to the zombie plague that was sweeping the world, and when the film came out, that reference was missing, clearly to satisfy Chinese censors, who nevertheless refused to book the film in the Chinese theaters.
Michael Berry, speak to that. I mean, we've got one listener saying, so how long before the Chinese government is a major decider on what we hear in the U.S. see and don't see on the big screen? What about it, Michael?
Well, I think for Chinese filmmakers or other artists working within China, the whole idea, not so much of censorship, but I think even more powerful is self-censorship, because after decades of having those censorship rules in place, even the invisible ones, artists know where those lines are and they know what not to cross if they want their work to be produced and
Chinese
distributed.
Chinese artists, yeah.
Chinese artists. Mm-hmm. And so that's already been in place for a long time. And as these foreign or Hollywood film companies come to the table, there's so much financial gains at stake, and in these huge budget movies, they're not going to take a risk of being bold in their content so as to risk, you know, the second largest film market, and as if Wang Jianlin is correct, in a couple of years, the biggest film market in the world. And so I think more and more a lot of Hollywood studios are subscribing to those, the rules of the game, so to speak, and they know that if they want to come to China's table, they have to play by those rules.
Laurie Burkett in Beijing. For a long time, Hollywood has just casually thrown in bad guys from Russia or China, easily, casually, without even thinking about it. Now we've got a listener here asking, will the thrillers, that is, if China is deeply involved in the production, will the thrillers always have an evil foreign empire in North America trying to invade their peaceful country? What do you think, Laurie?
Well, I mean, that's up for grabs as to who the villain is going to be. But I do think it's clear that they don't want Chinese to be seen as the villain. And I was very curious in the most recent Iron Man as to whether or not we would have the Mandarin, that name, be used in the Chinese version. And, of course, it was not. So there was not this idea of the evil Mandarin character. But I do think that we're definitely seeing, I mean, Michael, I think you're right, that we're seeing there's more of a self-censorship on both sides. But I also think that the Chinese censorship is evolving. There was one film this year called Finding Mr. Right. And when I watched it, I was actually quite shocked because this movie touched on a ton of different themes that are quite sensitive in China. It had a lesbian in it as a leading character. It had a woman who was having an extramarital affair and going to the U.S. to have a baby overseas. These are really sensitive topics in China, and yet they were totally welcomed on screen, and the film did quite well here. So I think we're seeing also a censorship that is evolving, and there is some pushing of limits, both in creativity and I think within the censorship itself. That whoever those guys are sitting on the board, they seem to be either getting younger or a little bit more lenient.
We'll see how far that goes. Let's get another call here from New Orleans. Ivan is calling. Hi, Ivan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment is one of the things I've not heard mentioned, maybe over mm-hmm. missed, was how much Chinese cinema already has a global audience. I also think that Americans tend to have a sense of cultural superiority. And in terms of valuing Asian cinema, I've long been a consumer and fan of particularly the Chinese cinema, and have seen its technology, its innovation, its storytelling as really superseding Hollywood. And to see them converge, I think, is a wonderful thing. But I also have concerns about how those things, those values get translated and what gets determined as suitable by the Chinese production companies for American audiences. For example, I saw a Jackie Chan film, Rumble in the Bronx, from a student of mine long before it was released. And in that film, there was a scene of an African-American woman singing in Cantonese, which to me was just a powerful image. But for the American release of it, those scenes were edited out. It was seen suitable for a Chinese audience, but not for an American audience.
Interesting. Interesting. There's going to be all kinds of cultural interaction. Full disclosure, way back in the day, I used to have a small part in producing kind of provincial, really funky, cool Chinese kung fu films for international distribution. And yes, it had that kung fu rapper, but there were very intriguing and magnetic stories that were told there. I have a soft spot for all that. On the other hand, blockbusters can all tend to converge after a little while. We'll see where we go. One more call. Thank you, Ivan. Savannah, Georgia. Jorg is calling. Jorg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a professor at the Savannah College of Art and Design, and I'm calling in because last year when I visited Shanghai, there was a film called Back to 1942, which was very big in the theaters in Shanghai at that point in time. And I've noticed that this film was featuring Adrian Brody and Tim Robbins, and I also noticed before that Zhang Yimou was making in Flowers of War. He had cast Christian Bale. So I do think that there is a recipe becoming apparent on how the Chinese film market is going to try to break more into the international market simply by casting internationally well-known actors.
Very interesting in itself, Jorg. Thank you very much for that. John Horn, can you feel that urge in L.A., in Hollywood, to get on the Chinese bandwagon, get in on some of those big productions by actors there?
I think limited. I mean, I think Flowers of War is a very interesting case study that with Christian Bale, the star from Dark Knight. I mean, what you have to look at is whether or not American audiences are interested in seeing those films, which is really going to dictate what American actors are going to do. Flowers of War grossed $300,000 in the United States. That's what even a bomb like Battleship made in an hour.
Yeah.
It was a total fiasco. American audiences have very little interest in any kind of foreign language film. I think Crouching Tiger is kind of an outlier. I don't know if that was a great Chinese film or a great Ang Lee film. So that's kind of the exception to the rule. So I think if American actors are making those kinds of films and they're well received by American audiences, it doesn't matter what language they're in. But right now, American audiences are not interested in any kind of foreign language film.
What about co-production in China? I mean, if their market is going to grow as much as people are projecting, surely American filmmakers are going to want to have that. If that means making films in Mr. Wong's new facility in Qingdao, maybe they'll do it. You have a listener here who writes, they're finally outsourcing Hollywood. It was fun while it lasted. How much could move toward that market for production there, John, if it's big enough?
I think a lot. And in that case, I think it depends less on the Chinese audience than on the Chinese censors. Chinese audiences are clearly very open-minded. They're interested in Western storytelling. But if the Chinese censors, who are ultimately going to make the decisions of what is and is not a co-production, are more open-minded, are willing to take a look at a Chinese villain. I mean, Men in Black 3, the last Men in Black film, all the scenes in Chinatown were cut from the film in China because it was an unflattering depiction of people in Chinatown. So I think if Chinese censors are a little bit open-minded about what kind of storytelling they're willing to embrace, those co-productions can work. But if they're second-guessing storytelling and creative choices made by Hollywood and in the process kind of diluting the stories, it's not going to work because they're going to end up with very bland movies that the international, the global audience is not interested in seeing.
Matt in Columbus, Georgia. Matt, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I called really to agree with the gentleman just said before. When a movie goes to Hollywood, a good story goes to Hollywood, it often gets pared down to make the film flow for more money. And what's happening, the trend lately, in the past 5 years, 6 years, movies are being made for the international market, and the story is suffering as a result. The action movies become more action-y, and the plot gets weaker and weaker. Case in point would be the Bourne Identity movies. The third Bourne Identity movie was meant to be an international success, and it was, but at the same time, the movie really had a terrible plot and didn't make a lot of sense when you saw the whole thing. I mean, I'm all for making movies for that everybody can see, but, you know, if the story is going to suffer, then there's no point to me.
Yeah, Matt, I appreciate your call. Michael Berry, what do you say? We had Ivan calling from New Orleans saying there are a lot of Chinese films he really admires, but in the globalization of the film business, does it mean a kind of a lowest denominator, homogenized action blockbuster becomes the norm?
Well, I think that's certainly one of the greatest pitfalls, and that is that as studios on both sides go to get the biggest chunk of the pie, and that is trying to conquer both markets, they start pandering to the lowest common denominator. They want a film that's going to please everybody. And the reality is that certain markets do have different tastes, and there are different cultural sensibilities in different markets, and there's certainly, one thing that Ivan said that I completely agree with and I think can't be stressed enough is there's an incredible cultural imbalance between the U.S. and China. A lot of people talk about trade imbalance, but even that probably is shadowed by this cultural imbalance. You ask, you know, a random person in China on the street to name a dozen Hollywood actors and directors, they'll name double that for you. Mm-hmm. If you ask your typical American to name a couple of famous Chinese actors or directors, maybe besides Jackie Chan and Jet Li, they're going to run out of names very quickly. And I think that cultural imbalance is, and that comes from a long history of American kind of monolingualism and ethnocentrism and not looking out to the world or feeling a need to look out to the world, whereas China is very interested in Hollywood, very interested in the world. And so I think earlier Laurie was saying that Hollywood films, they'll do very well in China without the Chinese elements. You don't necessarily need those Chinese elements to sell a Hollywood film. Those are often added for the sake of the censors or for the Chinese co-production partners. But audiences themselves are very open and very much interested in more Hollywood product coming in directly. A lot of this is a result of the quota system and ways to get around it. And part of that has led Chinese companies to make films more like Hollywood because they can't get enough of the real thing, and Hollywood to make more films that are bringing in these Chinese elements so that they can qualify as co-productions.
Laurie Birkett, in Beijing, do you see, I mean, embedded in so many Hollywood productions is some face or another of the American dream, something about freedom and agency, a certain kind of brashness, let's just go do this. Do you see, Laurie, a Chinese dream of life, of organization, of society that would power real global popularity of films out of a Chinese Hollywood?
That's a really interesting and tough question, because I think we're in an era where people are within China trying to ask themselves, what is the Chinese dream? And it's actually used often within the government as kind of a slogan and a catchphrase to redirect people to come up with what the Chinese dream is. I think for some time it has been very similar to the American dream of being able to find success and this idea of meritocracy. But I do think that it's quite difficult in Chinese society for people to chase that. And it has become something that people long for. And I'm not certain that the Chinese, I do think the Chinese dream is similar to most people. Everyone wants to strive and to work hard and to be able to succeed. And this is, something, a storyline that resonates within Hollywood globally in any country, right? So I don't think it's unique to any one country, but it certainly has been an American dream, and I do think it is a Chinese one, but I don't know if it will show up within the movies that come out of this country.
Big market, big culture, big questions about where it's going to go, and a big push on right now. Laurie Birkett with the Wall Street Journal in Beijing, Michael Berry in Santa Barbara, John Horn with the Los Angeles Times. Thanks to all of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.